Thank you, David. And let me begin by thanking everybody here at the Institute for Theoretical Physics for a wonderful day and a half. I learned a lot. It's a remarkable place in many, many ways. And it's a real pleasure to be here tonight. Let me begin by taking you back some 2,200, 2,300 years when the great Greek philosophers were really beginning to pose questions that scientists have mulled over for those many years. And among three of the more remarkable questions that Socrates and Aristotle have given us are questions about ourselves. They wanted to know, who are we? Who are we? Where did we come from? What are our origins? And why are we here? Right. Those were the three major questions that philosophers pondered. What's a little bit remarkable about the project I'm going to tell you about tonight, the Genome Project, is that it actually begins to address some of the aspects of two of those three questions. We're going to hear a little bit about the parts manual for making a human being, and in part, like the first anatomists in Greece, in part, that's a little bit of who we are. I'll tell you much more about where did we come from, because we can begin to, through understanding our own genes, begin to reconstruct the evolution of human beings. And so we can say a fair amount with great certainty about where we came from within a reasonable amount of time. Where science doesn't delve at all, why are we here? I will have nothing to say. Your ministers and your rabbis and priests are going to have to handle that one. So I will not dwell upon the third question the Greeks asked, which was really quite an interesting question. And from these great Greek philosophers, we fast forward with great irony to the spring of the year 2000. And it's great irony because it's at the White House and the President Clinton and Tony Blair, who's on the TV coming in for the White House, are announcing the completion of the sequence of the human genome, the spring of 2000. It was actually April of 2000, 3 years ago. And the reason I say it's very ironical is for a number of reasons. The genome wasn't completed at the time they announced that it was completed. It was filled with errors and holes. Secondly, the reality of the situation, it's like everything else you read in the newspapers, it's not at all what had really happened, was that the last previous 2 years, 2.5 years, was a furious race between two different research groups, one publicly funded in the United States and Great Britain and in Japan, was the so-called public consortium, was sequencing the human genome at a very slow pace. In 1997 and 1998, they had about 3% of the genome done at the time. When a private group, a little biotech company called Celera, announced that it was going to sequence the human genome, and it was purchasing some 300 of the new machines that were made to sequence the human genome, and it figured it'd be done in 2 years, and that the Human Genome Project, the one that's publicly funded with our tax dollars, ought to forget about it, because they're going to get their pants beaten off. And a race was begun that was politically very heated, that caused a lot of problems in the field. Everybody was on one side or the other for various reasons. Of course, the private enterprise system didn't use taxpayers' dollars. I guess that's the really good thing about it. But also was prepared to distribute the information that came from the human genome for a price to every laboratory. They're going to charge a lot of money to pharmaceutical companies and a little bit of money to every lab, and you could see a peek at the human genome. And the public consortium had as their philosophy every day when they sequenced 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 units of bits of information, they dumped it into the public domain. And on a daily basis, scientists around the world could tap into the information, which was completely free and open, but unannotated, so that you really didn't know where you were in the genome at the time. Like all other events of that type, the race was difficult. The race was problematic, but probably the competition was the best thing that ever happened to the Human Genome Project. It got its act together. And what Clinton was declaring in the spring of 2000 was a tie. Everybody won. Nobody should yell and scream. Nobody could patent any of the genes. Should be for the public domain, and it was going to be a real tie. And of course, as I said, it wasn't finished in the year 2000. So for the scientists, we read the newspapers. I went on Charlie Rose's show to talk about the genome that week. In fact, he had a whole genome set of genome shows. And all of us hardly could keep it in that it really wasn't finished. Right? It really was still not finished in many, many ways. But it gets better and better and better, and we can I can give an interim report on the human genome in the year spring of 2003 that really contains a lot of very interesting information and begins to address the questions that I told you about that were formulated by the Greeks. Who are we and where did we come from? And then many more questions which I'll dwell on. So let me introduce you to, this is a physics institute, so let me introduce you to biology. 101, and we'll take just one slide on biology 101 and tell you a little bit about basic definitions, and that will be a good place for us to start. First of all, chromosomes in higher organisms like us come in pairs, and we have 23 chromosomes, and we have them twice. Right? The one exception is for males, so you have an X and a Y, of course, and for females, two X's. But we have 23 chromosomes twice. To give you an idea, our closest living relative, who we'll talk about a bit tonight, the chimpanzee, has 24 chromosomes twice. We separated on the line. We had a common ancestor with the chimpanzee about 3.5 million years ago, which might have had 24 chromosomes. So somewhere along the line, as the chimpanzees separated from us, we're about 7 million years apart now. 3.5 million years ago, we had a common ancestor. Somewhere along the line, two of the chimpanzee chromosomes fused and gave us 23. And in fact, we know which ones are fused and which ones have been made us a human and a little bit different than the chimpanzee. Secondly, chromosomes are made up of a number of complex chemicals, mostly the chemical DNA and the chemical protein. And actually, for a long time, right up to 1944 or so, there was a big dispute in biology about whether DNA was the genetic information or protein was the genetic information. And actually, most biologists thought proteins were the genetic information because they're more complex in their chemistry than is DNA. DNA is a polymer which is made up of four subunits that repeat. And those subunits have chemical letters that we give them. Here they are. It's a DNA contains a polymer, and the chemical letters are C, G, A, or T, and they are called nucleotides, or bases, and they come in pairs. That's this famous double helix that Watson and Crick, there's the picture of the double helix right here. Right? That one here, you can see it at the bottom, Watson and Crick had. And each one of these is a base or a nucleotide, and it's either A, G, C, or T. So we have 23 chromosomes, and the chromosomes we now know, 1944, Avery, McLeod at Rockefeller Medical Research Institute demonstrated that DNA was the genetic material. So we've settled that question in the early 40s. And by 1953, Watson and Crick uncover the structure of DNA, and the structure of DNA is in this very beautiful double helix where any one strand can be read C, G, A, T, by just reading the bases. Now, one of the problems all along, ever since Mendel in the 1850s, we knew that genetic information contained information. So the information to build a human being, and not only that, it was building a human being that looked an awful lot like the parents. Right? So there was information passed down from generation to generation. The information was in the chromosomes. We found that out in the early 1900s. It was DNA in 1944. So how can a chemical contain information? And really, right from even before Watson and Crick, but clearly when Watson and Crick really talked about the structure of DNA for the first time, it became apparent that with only four, in fact, it was one of the arguments against this, with only four possible bases, A, G, G, or C. How much information could you have, right? It didn't seem like you could have enough information to build a human being from just four parts. But you can use that information in sequence. So it's exactly like the Morse code. The Morse code, of course, is a binal code, or any computer code is a binal code, 0 or 1 or dot or dash. And dot, 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 dash means something. It means the letter V. And so by putting these together in a sequence, you get information. And that's, in fact, what happens in this polymer. Each of these A's, T's, G's, and C's are found in a sequence, and it's the sequence that contains the information. And that's why the project was to sequence the human genome, because if you decode the sequence, if you understood the sequence, you'd understand all the parts that you inherit and that make up a human being. And that was the project, in fact, for that. So genes are sections of DNA, and what genes do, they are our blueprints, if you will. They contain information, and in the sequence of the A's, T's, G's, and C's are the information. And in it, that information is transcribed from one molecule to another, and then translated literally into a second kind of chemical proteins, which are also polymers, much more complex, as I've indicated. They have 20 subunits, right? So these 20 subunits are made up into a polymer, and a protein is the molecule of action, right? So a good example of a protein that you're all using right now is insulin, right? Insulin, there's a gene for insulin, contains the information for making the protein insulin. The reason you're all using it is you've just had dinner, you're digesting your food, sugar is being liberated into your blood, and in order for you to use that sugar in a productive way to generate energy, insulin is secreted by your pancreas and driving the sugar, glucose, into your cells to be degraded into small molecules so the energy could be used for thinking and seeing and moving muscles, right? All of that requires chemical energy that's obtained. You're also using oxygen to break down the glucose, and that's carried from your lungs by a protein, hemoglobin. Hemoglobin's in your red blood cells, and there's a gene for hemoglobin, just as there's a gene for insulin. And the proteins are the molecules of action. They're digesting your food, they're bringing in your oxygen. They are your hair, your teeth, your nails, your skin. The proteins are the molecules of action, and DNA are the molecules that are in your chromosomes. So we have the basic definitions. What have we learned from the Human Genome Project? What did we get right away from sequencing the human genome here now from the perspective of the year 2003? First of all, there are about 3 billion A's, T's, G's, and C's that make up the human genome. So if you wanted a number to hang yourself on, how complex are we? We're about 3 billion bits of information, A's, T's, G's, and C's in complexity. We're far from the most complex or the least complex with regard to numbers. Just to give you an idea, some of the simplest viruses are 5,200 A's, T's, G's, and C's. They may contain 8 genes. A gene is the information to make a protein, a functional unit. Right, so there's a gene for hemoglobin, a gene for insulin. A gene is the functional unit. It's the parts manual, if you will. So a virus can be as simple as 7 or 8 genes, 5,200 A's, T's, G's, and C's. A bacteria may have 3,000 genes. Some bacteria as small as 1,000 to 3,000 genes. And they may have 3 million A's, T's, G's, and C's. Bacteria are among the simplest organisms that are free living. Viruses are parasites. They're not even free living. They're so small, so they're not very complex. Worms and flies, they're probably intermediate, or 600 million years separated from, we're separated from worms and flies. By about 600 million years, we had a common ancestor a long time ago, something to think about, right? What our common ancestor with worms and flies might have looked like. It's probably looked more like worms and flies than us, for sure. Worms and flies, they have about 15 to about 13 to about 18,000 genes, right? So they are moving up in complexity, right? And they're intermediate in the amount of DNA they have. And finally, human beings. We have 3 billion A's, T's, G's, and C's. And a bit surprising to us is we have about 30,000 genes. Now, biologists are no different than any other anthropomorphic kind of human being. We started making bets a long time ago how many genes it would be to make a human being. I bet about 100,000. Most people were about 120,000. Almost no one bet 30,000. It seemed so simple to have a parts manual to make something as complex as us, as having 30,000 A's, T's, G's, and C's combined together to make a functional unit, right? But it's true. This is an estimate, let me rush to tell you. The genome is very complex. It doesn't use all the 3 billion bits of information in the genome to make a gene. It only uses about 2% of the information to make a gene. So we're estimating many of these genes based on an open region that makes a protein, that we think makes a protein. So we're guessing at about 30,000 genes, but that's a pretty good estimate, but that's what it is. It's an estimate. It might be 35, it might be 28, but it's probably not 100 for sure. What happens in the complexity of this, though, is we now know that many genes, one gene may make many proteins. So it could be that, a gene is a bit of information, you can splice and patch that information in such a way. So you take the start part of it, and the middle part of it, and the end part of it, and you splice them together, and you get a different protein than if you took the whole thing in information, right? Or if you just took the first half, you get a different protein than if you took the whole thing, right? So we do know that genes can make more than one protein now, and those proteins are related. They're obviously closely related by, they share information, the proteins. They share the first half of the gene, for example, in the example I gave. But having said that, they're related, they have different, slightly different functions. So we're guessing now, but we think there may be as many as 30,000 genes and 100 to 150,000 proteins to make up a human being. And that, in a raw sense, is the parts manual that I told you about. We can take this information, decode it from the 3 billion base pairs, and make a parts manual, make a book that says, here are all the genes that make a human being. Now, to give you a flavor for what that means to us, the biologists, it would be the rough equivalent is if we took apart a Boeing 747 and wrote up all its parts in a book and gave you the book, you wouldn't have the foggiest idea what that was, first of all, or even how to assemble it. And that's where we are, right? We have a parts manual based on the genome, but how it's assembled and how it functions is a great challenge for the future. Now, we know some things because we've studied biology for a long time, and I'll take you through some of those things. But just to give you a flavor of having a parts manual does not tell you how those parts work together. We do know the end product. We know it's a human being, and we do know a lot about a human being, but we don't know the intermediate steps very, very well. But this gives us our parts manual. And finally, about function. So function's very important. I told you, I chose a couple of genes we know the function of. Insulin, right, is a gene, and I told you what its function is. It's to drive sugar. You secrete it in response to sugar. It drives glucose into the cells. You use it for energy. That's actually its function. Hemoglobin, it binds oxygen in your lungs, delivers oxygen to the cells, burns glucose to give you energy, collects carbon dioxide, brings it back to your lungs where you exhale carbon dioxide. That's the function of hemoglobin, right? So how many of these genes, these 30,000 genes, do we know the function of? Probably about half. This is a map of function, if you will. It's just too small to bother reading. But we only know about, so here we've decoded 30,000 parts in our manual, of which about half we know. I could stand here if I wanted to list 15,000 functions, presumably I would know the 15,000 functions that we know. But that's daunting. It tells us that we have a lot more in front of us. So this is not the end of biology, the sequence. It's the beginning of biology in many, many ways. Okay. Now, among the most wonderful things that comes to us by sequencing genomes is not to stop with human beings. And the Genome Project from the beginning didn't ever envision just sequencing a human being. It was called the Human Genome Project so that the congressmen and the senators would be most impressed with the fact that we were sequencing human beings. But we cared about sequencing a bacteria, a yeast organism, a fly, a worm, a mouse, the chimpanzee, and the human. Because those were the organisms that were either close to us, we wanted to find out what's different between chimpanzees and humans, or they were the organisms we used in the laboratory. And we wanted to know how closely we were related to those organisms. and tell us something about where we came from, right? How close are the parts manuals for a yeast and a human being? Can you recognize in a yeast organism, we're almost 2 billion years separated from, can you recognize in a yeast organism the genes that you see in a human being? Would be an interesting question. So here's some answers to those things for our two closest neighbors that we have sequences for. We have humans, of course, and then we have chimpanzees and we have mice. And the first thing to say is the chimp is about 90, well, I'm now going to restrict myself to just those coding regions, just those regions that contain information that make protein, right? And when I do that, the chimp is about 99, actually it's about 99.9%, 99% similar to us, right? So there's only 1% difference between the chimp and us when it comes to that informational part of the DNA, right? And that there's a lot of humility in that if you think about it. That's a very, very small difference. Now, this is a parts manual again, so I'll rush to say, it says nothing about the amount of protein that's made. Could be there's different amounts. And it says nothing about the timing of the protein. Could be during development of the chimp or the human, or in puberty in the chimp and the human, the same gene is used differently. So it doesn't say anything about place and time and amount. It just says we share 99% parts, genes, right? And that's really kind of interesting that we're very close to chimps. And as I mentioned to you, we now can put a biological clock on that. The anthropological record has shown us to be 7 million years separated from chimps. So we're 7 million years is a clock that changed 1% of the sequence for us, and we start to relate a clock to changes, right? Evolution. The mouse is about 95% similar to us. That's perhaps even more striking. Just pause for a minute and realize that you and a mouse are about 95% identical, right? And that's not something you would intuitively have said before this talk, but quantitatively that's actually true. And that has very interesting meaning to us. Now, I should say, when I say identical, I mean it that I could recognize the gene in the mouse and in the human, and I can say they're the same because they have the same A's, T's, G's, and C's sequences, very similar ones, right? But I can be even more daring. I could take the insulin gene from a mouse and knock it out, and the mouse would become diabetic. Or I could take the hemoglobin gene from a mouse and knock it out, and the mouse would be dead, right? And then I can replace it with a human gene for insulin, or a human gene for hemoglobin, and I would rescue the mouse. So that tells you that, in fact, these molecules are not only structurally similar, but they're functionally similar. And this rescue experiment I could carry on in great detail. So the most interesting rescue experiment has been done with a little transistor that we have. We have, among the genes that we can recognize throughout all of evolution, a little genes that work in signal transduction pathways. Let me give you an example of a signal transduction pathway. You go outside tomorrow morning and maybe it'll be sunny. It wasn't this morning, but maybe it'll be sunny. And the sun will shine and it will shine on your skin. And it has energy and it will cause a mutation in your skin. And that mutation in the DNA of your skin will be recognized by an alarm system. And that alarm system will either allow it to repair or kill the cell. That's why David said the gene that I discovered in my lab at Princeton is called the death gene, because it's responsible for recognizing that this is a bad thing that happened to your skin and it kills it and prevents you from getting cancer. You don't get skin cancer all the time because these mutations tend to be eliminated. That's a good example of a stimulus from the outside being translated all the way to the inside of a cell and recognizing stress and damage and responding to it. And among the signalings, the proteins that do this signaling, is a small protein, which is a transistor. Like every transistor has two states, on and off. Too much sun, on. Too little sun, off. Right? So that's the transistor. And we can recognize this transistor in humans, and it's important in cancer. If you lose your transistor, you don't recognize that you've got a sunburn and you do get skin cancer, right? So it's important in humans if you have a mutation in this transistor. It happens to be called a RAS oncogene. Right? That's its technical name, but it's a little transistor. Yeast have that same transistor. You knock it out in yeast, the yeast dies. Put in the human gene, it works. Rescues the life of the yeast. Right? So when Lewis Thomas pointed out that someday we were going to understand the continuity of life, right? It's a couple of billion years of continuity, we can swap genes. The evolution has preserved many of these genes functionally. And this is a great example of a similarity between us. So we're very similar to the mouse. And what it says is the mouse is a terrific experimental animal to understand disease processes in human beings. That's what it's, that's the take-home message from this. Now, let me introduce you to some similarities between us and between chimps. Remember I said, so we have about 3 billion A's, T's, G's, and C's, right? And the chimpanzee and a human being are about 1% different. So that means that there are 30 million A's, T's, G's, and C's, because there are 3 billion to start with. 1% is a big number. There are 30 million A's, T's, G's, and C's which are different between mice and humans, right? Between chimpanzees and humans. That's our closest living relative. So there are a lot of differences. Just even if it's 1%, there are a lot, because there's 3 billion and now there's 30 million. Between two human beings, between any two of you in the audience, there's only 0.1% difference. Not 1%, tenfold less. But that does mean that there are 3 million differences in A's, T's, G's, and C's between your neighbors, right? Now, of course, the males and females have a very big difference, the Y chromosome, and I'm not counting that, right? But in our chromosomes, there are about 3 million A's, T's, G's, and C's that are different. And I just want to show you that, because this is the basis in which it works. So let's say in the general population, go back to the basic definitions here, the sequence on a particular gene was ACTCAGTT, right? And most people in this room have that sequence. Let's say 55 people have that sequence. But 10 people have a different sequence. They have ACT, that's the same. CAG, that's the same. And then let's put an A in here, right? AT. And that's a single nucleotide change. We call change polymorphisms, poly, many, morphisms, shape, right? So they have big effects, right? These shapes, many of them have big effects. And so it's called a single nucleotide polymorphism, or we abbreviate the differences between people as SNPs, right? SNP, SNPs, right? So what we know is that these alterations in DNA sequences are called polymorphisms, alterations of a single base pair, the T to an A, let's say, is a SNP, and that this is the basis for much of human variation. So remember, I told you, you're all 99.9% similar, right? And yet you look around the room and everybody's recognizably as different, right? And that's due in large part to these 3 million SNPs that make us different one from the other, right? So there's a remarkable thing about our similarity. We're actually, as you'll see in a minute, an extremely young species. That's why we're so similar. We're 99% identical to everybody in the room. And yet, there are 3 million differences because of that, and those are the things that make us individuals. Now, it's this kind of information in specific regions of the DNA that allows us to reconstruct our evolution. Right? Let me give you an example of that. Suppose that humans arose 100 to 150,000 years ago in Africa, and that all humans were black, and they lived in Africa at the time, and they started to multiply, and they started to get a change in their DNA, right? So that the population of 10,000 humans now had half with A and half with T at that position, right? So you'd imagine then that that's a very old change, and that carrying forward to today, half of us might have A and half of us might have T if everybody survived and multiplied, right? And we could say then that that is a very old change because we share it all in that fashion, right? However, during the 100,000 years as we developed, some people who were in Europe got another change. And that change is peculiar to everyone who lives in Europe. And some people in Asia got another change, and that's peculiar to people who lived in Asia, but it's on top of the first change that you got in Africa, right? So you can see that I could use these changes to reconstruct the migrations of humans out of Africa, right? And in fact, that's been done. It's been done twice by two research groups. The first group did it, and they did it on very choice pieces of DNA. The first group did it on a piece of DNA called mitochondrial DNA, because that DNA is transferred only through the female line. So forget about it, guys. You get your mitochondrial DNA from your mother, and it's dead at that point. You never pass it on. It's only your sister that's going to pass that on, right? So it's a piece of DNA that's passed on only through the female line. But guys get their chance. The Y chromosome, of course, is passed along only on the male line, right? So by looking for these polymorphisms in mitochondria, we can trace the female lineage throughout evolution. And by looking on the Y chromosome, we can trace the male lineages throughout evolution. Right? And this is very powerful, because when they agree, we really believe that. Right? And they do indeed agree as to what happened. So let me go back and tell you what happened. Right? As I told you, we really believe now that the first humans that were like us, by like us I mean that could have, we think, bred with us, interbred with us, and had fertile offspring. The first humans that are really like us arise between 100,000 and 150,000 years ago in Africa, right? And that's a remarkable fact right there. We're an extremely young species. We're only 100 to 150,000 years old as a breeding species, right? That's quite young. We arise in Africa. The first migration out of Africa, the group builds up to a critical mass, we think maybe 20, 30, 40,000 people. And a small subset of that group, which have their own SNPs, right? Everybody has SNPs there. Now that you're starting to, in fact, if you say 100,000 years ago, that's actually only 5,000 generations ago, right? If you take every generation is 20 years, right? It's 5,000 generations ago. We're a very young species, right? We're all related a lot, right? Okay, so that the first group starts to migrate out, we think, at about somewhere between 70 and 90,000 years ago. The first group leaves Africa. There's a black Africans leaving Africa with their own SNPs. In fact, they have a subset of SNPs of all the people in Africa. And where do they go? The first group goes to southern China, is here. It goes to India. And it passes along 100,000, 70,000 years ago, a land mass that connects Asia to Australia. Right? And that group settles in southern China, in Australia, in India, and is the first migration out of Africa, 70,000 years ago. Right? The closest living relatives to that group genetically, we think, are the Australian Aborigines, and because they've been isolated reproductively for a long time, they really have the same SNPs that you can see in Africa, right? And the small island, small island off of India here. This small island has a population of people who have been reproductively isolated, and they have SNPs that are very similar to African SNPs, right? But after that, the Indians and the Chinese, the southern Chinese, are evolving and gaining new SNPs with time, and they're peculiar to that geography. About 40,000 years ago, the second migration leaves Africa, and it goes probably through the same route, right through where our army is today in Iraq, right through Iraq to go to northern China, right? And it settles in northern China about 30 or 40,000 years ago. Now, what was really interesting is that they're genetically, now because of these SNPs, we can tell on that Y chromosome or the mitochondrial chromosome, we can tell that these people are genetically related to the blacks in Africa, but now are evolving quite separately. They're not in a cross-mating population. They're getting their own SNPs. And we could tell they're genetically distinct, the northern Chinese and the southern Chinese. Well before we knew that, the linguists told us that the northern Chinese and the southern Chinese had language that was distinct. Their language structure was totally independent. So they're evolving language that's just another code, like the genetic code. This is a linguistic code that reinforces what we see with the genetic code, the change. Parenthetically, it's about somewhere between 12 and 15,000 years ago that the northern Chinese cross over the Bering Straits, become the Native Americans, the Eskimos, the Plains Indians, and then finally the South American Indians. And so they're very young. That group, in that Native American group, is quite closely related to the Northern Chinese at only 14 or 12,000 years ago, very few generations ago. And finally, about 20,000 years ago, the last migration comes out of Africa, and it goes up to Europe. And that's 20,000 years is an interesting time because the Ice Age is just pulling back. So Europe's covered with ice. Everybody's down at the Mediterranean at the beginning. And those wonderful caves that we see, these first pictures of human hands and buffalo and things, these caves in France and in Spain, those caves are made by our relatives who have come out of Africa some 20,000 years ago and who encounter and replace the Neanderthals. All over, we're encountering and replacing the Neanderthals. Who are the Neanderthals? We now got a little DNA from Neanderthal, from a Neanderthal bone, and we now know they're a different species than us. They're really quite distinct. We would estimate that they arose in Africa about 500,000 years ago. We about 150,000, but they about 500,000, and they left Africa well before us, and we came out and probably killed them all off, or outcompeted them. We hardly know much about Neanderthals and whether we mated with them, whether any offspring would be fertile, but we don't think so based on the snippets of DNA we've gotten from their bones. Right? So the Neanderthals were our really closest cousins on the separation of chimpanzee to human 3.5 million years. Neanderthals are only 500,000 years back, right? And we're 150. So they are close to us, but probably a different species. So this is the history you can reconstruct by looking at us, at our genetic information, and looking at the differences between us, not the similarities, but the differences. You can find out that there are people that live in Europe and the United States now who have SNPs, who have single nucleotide polymorphisms unique to the Caucasian group that evolved in Europe from the Africans that we came from. And the Chinese have unique SNPs, the Northern and Southern Chinese, right? And those SNPs are different. Everybody has common SNPs with the Africans, the black Africans, especially. And they're common SNPs because we all come from the origins in black Africa. Right? So the Greeks, when they asked, where do we come from? We can start to fill in. This is not exactly where we came from, but we now know the neighborhoods, right, of where we came from and our evolution, right, and our history. In the biological terms. Now, what can we do with these SNPs? I had stressed throughout all of that the similarities between us. Now let's talk about the differences between us, because after all, there are 3 million of them. And what the human genome sequence did for us was it tried very hard at the beginning to find out something about the differences between us. So one of the big questions, in 1991, I sat on a panel at the National Institutes of Health to answer what seems like a silly question, but turned out to be a very serious one. The question was, whose genome should we sequence, right? Now that, if you think about it, is a pretty serious question. Should we immortalize someone, right? What should we sequence? Should we do it anonymously? Should we know the person who we sequence or what? Now, I have to say, my good friend Sidney Brenner had the best idea for who we should sequence. He suggested we get the 10 richest men in the world in a room and let them bid for it. Right? And they would have. But we didn't do that. It somehow didn't seem ethical at the time. So what was done was that actually 50 people agreed to donate sperm. Now, let me say also, we also decided if we had to sequence someone's DNA, we probably didn't want to sequence your lymphocytes or your somatic cells, because your body as it grows up accumulates mutations and changes just to duplicate yourself. And those mutations never pass on to your offspring. So they would be called somatic mutations and probably of little consequence unless you develop disease from them. Right? So we decided to do sperm. Right? And we decided to do sperm rather than eggs because sperm was easier to get, but also because sperm had the Y chromosome in it. Right? And so what we would get by doing sperm was we collected the sperm anonymously from 50 people who donated sperm. We then let a random generator pick 5 of them. Right? So no one knows who those people are. Right? And then those 5 were sequenced simultaneously to reconstruct an average genome of five people. Right? So you immediately could tell that since your DNA and my DNA, if we had were the donors, would be different at 3 million places, that we're going to find along the path some differences as we resequence the DNA, as we assemble the sequence. And those are called single nucleotide polymorphisms, and that's why we did five and not one person. We'd only have one sequence, right? So this company, Celera, however, has now begun to resequence at larger scale. So I'm going to tell you about their resequencing effort. This is the Aplera or Celera Genome Initiative. They resequenced 39 human beings and one chimpanzee. Now, they obviously resequenced the chimp out of interest to see what was different between us and the chimp. Remember, I told you, we're 0.1% different. We and a chimp are 1% different, so they wanted to see where they were. 39 human beings, in this case, were all females. The reason for all females is that everyone has two chromosomes, as I've told you. If you're doing 39 people, then you're getting 78 chromosomes, right? And that's what you really wanted, was a lot of chromosomes. If you did males, then you would only get 39 X's. We wanted double X's. The reason that the Y was not of very much interest, and I hate to say this with half the audience looking male here, the Y is mostly junk, actually. Now, that's just reality, I'm afraid. There may be 20, 30 genes on the Y that we know about, and we can't find more, and the rest of it seems to be junk, right? I'm sorry, guys, but it's true. And so we didn't really want to get mired down in resequencing the Y a lot for just 20 or 30 genes. So this was all done with females. So this isn't the group that was sequenced, because they're males here as well. It was all females here. And here's just some raw numbers that came out of the... This is the resequencing of the genome now, right? We're looking for differences. So here's some of them that come out. Of the about 30,000 possible genes that were resequenced, 23,600, or 300 rather, were genes which successfully got resequenced, right? And that's just a technical reason why we couldn't do more. About 300,000 single nucleotide changes were discovered. Of those, and that's all over the genome, remember only 2% is informational, but of those 300,000, about 43,500 are considered potentially functional, found in the information itself, right? Now, the reason this is an interesting number, there are about 30,000 genes, there are about 43,500 changes. It's quite asymmetric. About 30% of the genes had no changes. Now, that you'd expect for hemoglobin, right? We all have pretty much the same hemoglobin, and anybody that has a different hemoglobin has a disease. So there's a mutation in the hemoglobin gene that gives rise to sickle cell anemia. Right? Because the protein has changed and the gene has changed. There's another mutation that gives rise to a disease called thalassemia, prevalent in the Mediterranean population. So those are mutations that cause disease. These are changes that might have caused disease or might not, but we found none in hemoglobin in the 40 people that were sequenced, for example. So there's an asymmetry in the distribution of the mutations. And what's interesting about these mutations, and I'll continue in this theme now, to tell you why the genome's useful. What's interesting about these mutations, in the seeds of these mutations, are all the things that don't make each individual perfect. We're not perfect, right? We have imperfections. We have predilections to disease. Some people hear better than others. Some people see better than others. Some people run faster than others. Inherent in all these things is the genetic component in that difference between us. And here is the parts manual that starts to ask the question, what's different about us, right? And as I say, 30% of the genes don't have sequences at all. So let me now get to the hallmark of what you use the genome for medically, right? There's a big question medically, because remember I didn't say some were smarter than others, but I did say some of us run faster, some of us see better, some of us hear better, right? How do I know that those things are genetic rather than environmental? Obviously, for those of you who were in rock bands when you were young, you don't hear as well, and that has nothing to do with your genes, right? So there's an environmental component and a genetic component. How can I tease out an environmental component and a genetic component for each disease, right? And I'm going to tell you the way we do that. We do it very straightforward, and it really works, right? there are two kinds of twins that get born to human beings. One is called the monozygotic twin, and the other is called the dizygotic twin. A zygote is an egg, right? What is a monozygotic twin? A monozygotic twin is when the female has a single egg, the male fertilizes that egg with a single sperm. The egg now divides in two and makes a two-cell embryo. Each of the two cells separate and make an offspring, right? That's monozygotic, single zygote, single fertilized egg. Those are called identical twins, and they really are identical. They're clones, actually. All this hullabaloo about cloning happens naturally. It happens in utero, right? And it happens when two cells separate. And what's remarkable about humans is that two single cells can make two people that are equal genetically. And they're almost identical genetically, except for mistakes that are made during the replication, right? So they are monozygotic twins. So if one monozygotic twin is schizophrenia, and it's a genetically inherited disease, there's a high probability the other guy's going to get it, or the other lady's going to get it, but they're always the same sex, right? The high probability if it's a genetic disease. Now, then there are dizygotic twins. And what happens there is the female has two eggs, the male has two sperm. Now they're brothers and sisters, or two brothers or two sisters. They are genetically related. They come from the same parents, but they are non-identical, right? Because they have the mix of all the possible chromosomes from the grandparents, right? So if you're a monozygotic twin and you got schizophrenia, you'd have a certain probability of getting schizophrenia for the other twin. That would be genetic, almost surely, because they're brought up in the same family, the same environment. If you're a dizygotic twin, probability goes way down because you're not genetically identical if it was genetic, right? So here's the ratio. This is the ratio of monozygotic to dizygotic twins. This is the heritability index we can calculate. So if you have asthma, it's 60% of the predilection to asthma is inherited. 40 to 70% for high blood pressure, bone mineral density, something big, osteoclastic densities, or osteoporosis, for example, 60 to 80%, so forth. Breast cancer, 27%. Colon cancer, 35%. Prostate cancer, 42%. So we can calculate from these kinds of ratios the ways in which genetics contribute. They're not 100%. There's a nurture-nature problem. And this nurture-nature problem, we got an edge, right? But this is enough to tell us that these are diseases which we should study the genes. And we should look at the differences. Because if there's a gene that predisposes a woman in this room to breast cancer, right, we could now find it. We have the parts manual, and it will have a SNP in it that changes it, and it will contribute roughly 27% to the probability of developing breast cancer. Now, how do we do this? How is human genetics done? Mouse genetics is a wonderful thing because we can take a male and a female, we know their properties, we can mate them, and we can control the offspring. Human genetics is a disaster. We can't do any of that, right? We just have to take what we get, right? So how do we do human genetics? And this is the two ways that we do human genetics. We do either linkage studies, which are for families, right? Or we do what are called association studies. And either one is fine for our SNP hunt, right? Or hunt for the gene that has a SNP, right? So this is a great example of a linkage study. Suppose there were two traits. One was yellow, one was blue. So this is a great family because there's now in this family one, two, three, four, five generations where we can get DNA and they're alive. This never happens, I could tell you. But this is a family with five generations. Here are the great-great-great-great-grandparents, right? They're up here, if I can get them on the laser. Yeah. And what we found out was that the female was blue and the male was yellow, and they had offspring. They had a blue offspring here, and they had a blue offspring male here, and they married yellow offspring and down and down. And what we do is collect DNA from everybody in the family, and we ask the question, if you're blue, what SNPs do you have? And if you're yellow, what SNPs do you have? And then we line them up and we look for unique set of SNPs, unique set of changes in genes that follow the family trait blue or the family trait yellow, right? And that's called linkage studies. And we don't do it with one family because we don't believe in one family. We do it with dozens of families, and we have to find the same gene, right? Now, this is exactly what was done with the gene that I had found, called P53. There are about 450 families in the United States that have mutations, SNPs, single nucleotide change in the P53 gene. Right? And these people have predilection to get cancer. In fact, literally 100% of people who have this mutation develop cancer between the age of 30 and 45. Very young age. They get multiple cancers to boot. So they'll have two or three cancers over a lifetime. Right? And these families were picked up because they were cancer-prone families. And their SNPs were checked, and the P53 gene had a single nucleotide polymorphism, and of about 30 families, the correlation was 100% of carrying that change, right? So that was a good example of how family studies can discover a cancer gene, and we know this cancer gene plays a role now in human cancer, right? Then there are association studies where we line up a lot of people who we don't know their color, right? So they're green right now, right? Ahead of time, because we don't know what the trait is, right? But we let the disease develop, and everybody develops into either yellow or blue, right? Blue is normal, and yellow is a population of people that might have diabetes, let's say, right? And so we stratify the population to everyone who has diabetes and everyone who doesn't have diabetes, and we have a case and control study. And if we have 1,000 or 10,000 diabetics, and we have 10,000 matched normals. What's matched? Match for sex, economic background, all sorts of things. Match for socioeconomic backgrounds, match for sexual preferences. They're matched controls, and everybody in this group should have a SNP that's different than everybody in this group. Case control study, not an inheritance study, right? If we divided everybody up in the room between males and females here and took your DNA, we'd find out that the males have a Y chromosome, right? Have a Y piece SNP. Right, that the females don't have. That would be a case control study without doing a family. Right? And so we can do this kind of study, and now that we have the parts manual, we know where to look. Right? We can look at 24,000 places simultaneously, and we can look for those changes, those 43,000 changes that I told you about, and we can do the correlations very fast. This speeds up human genetics. This speeds up the genetic component of disease processes. So let me just give you one example. I'll finish up with one example here of what has been done here. I'll stay with my own field, cancer biology, and you'll recognize immediately a big problem in the therapy that we use for cancer. If, God forbid, someone gets cancer, let's say colon cancer is a good example, it's diagnosed. The first option is surgery, and you remove the cancer, right? Now, if you get all the cancer at that time, you do no more, right? But it's pretty rare, especially if it's advanced, that you get all the cancer. So the second option for treatment is chemotherapy. And some people respond to chemotherapy and actually the tumors shrink and they go away for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and some people don't. Now, why do some people respond to chemotherapy and some people don't respond to chemotherapy? How much of that is a genetic component? Could we tell ahead of time who would respond to chemotherapy and who wouldn't? Let me make it less theoretical. For example, if a woman gets breast cancer, the lump is removed frequently nowadays, right? Especially if it's small, but she will get 100% of the time adjuvant, what's called adjuvant chemotherapy, either radiation therapy or chemotherapy on the off chance that it would come back. 50% of the time it will not come back with or without chemotherapy. 50% of the time it will come back. That second 50% without chemotherapy reduces to about 10 or 15%. So all women get chemotherapy even though half don't need it. Right? Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to stratify women into those who respond to chemotherapy and those who would not respond and spare the women who don't respond chemotherapy, right? Even though that's the standard treatment today. Or spare the colon cancers chemotherapy if they're not going to be responders, right? And we can do that genetically. We can start to line up the cases and controls. All the women 5 years later that responded to chemotherapy, all the women who failed chemotherapy, you line them up and you look at their genes and you ask the question, what's different about them, right? And these are complex, large data sets of information that have a lot of noise in them. And so we have to really use sophisticated mathematics to tease out the information. Because sometimes it's not one gene that makes the difference, sometimes it's four or five genes. And so it's a combination of genes, and so you need large numbers to see that. Right? And the studies get very large, complicated, and a really interesting mathematical problems of teasing out information from a large database. Now, I'm going to take the prerogative of a speaker, and nobody can leave if I keep talking, to talk over, just to tell you about one more story, because this is a wonderful story about science, and it's a wonderful story with a great success. And I think it's the beginning of where our science is taking us in a very positive way. So I'm going to tell you a story about a very rare cancer called chronic myelogenous leukemia. Right? So it's a leukemia, it's a blood cancer. It's chronic. That means when you get it, you go about 5 years with a chronic phase of having too many white blood cells. These are called myeloid cells. These are cells of your white blood cell stream. You have too many of them, and you don't feel great, but it doesn't kill you. At the end of 5 years, a catastrophic event happens, and you get a burst of terrific number of cells, and the people die. And the treatment before the drug I'm going to tell you about, treatment for this cancer was bone marrow transplant. So you just irradiated the patient, got rid of all the cells, put in fresh cells, and hope they survived, right? About 50, 60% survived on those conditions. The disease is called chronic myelogenous leukemia, and the cause is in our genes, right? So here's our chromosomes. This is a nice picture. I remember I told you we had 23 chromosomes. We actually number them. We number them by size. We're very unimaginative. So chromosome 1 is the largest. Chromosome 23 is the smallest. Here's chromosome 9, right? It's over here on the left, if I can get this going. Right? Chromosome 9 is big, and chromosome 22 is small, right? And in chromosome 9, right at the tip there, there's a gene called ABL. ABL. It's named actually after a man named Abelson who discovered the gene. And that's a gene that can cause cancer. It actually was first found in mice causing cancer, or rats causing cancer. And it does cause cancer in human beings too. And then there's a second gene on chromosome 12, which is here called BCR, right? And we don't know much about the function of BCR, but it's another gene. Right? And they are normally in those positions in our chromosome. Right? So in the year 1962, actually when I was a graduate student, the guy down the hall, Peter Knoll, made a remarkable discovery. He found that everyone that had this disease, chronic myelogenous leukemia, didn't have 23 chromosomes like you were supposed to have. There was a change chromosome. Number 22 looked different, and it was different because it added a little bit of DNA on the end of the chromosome. So 22 changed and added the DNA. The DNA it added, he later found out, came from chromosome 9. We call that a translocation. Piece of chromosome 9 moves to chromosome 22, and right at the junction where you're essentially like taking two movies and splicing them together, right? You really lose the train of thought when you do that, right? And if they're two different movies, you've now spliced two different genes together, and you get a merger of the two genes. And that sets this ABL gene off, which is an oncogene, to cause the cancer, right? So this chromosome is correlated with the disease because it causes the disease. And we know the genes. So it was really 64, the chromosome translocation, 62, the chromosome translocation was found. By about 78, David Baltimore and his colleagues, Owen Witte, discovered the translocation was at these two genes, BCR ABL. They further discovered that the fusion gene, the gene that's now spliced together, made a fusion protein, a splice protein. And the protein had an activity. It was an enzyme, right? Enzymes are proteins which catalyze chemical reactions. Now, this one catalyzed the reaction of taking a phosphate group from a small chemical and putting it on a big one, on a protein. It's called a kinase, a protein kinase. It moves phosphate groups around. And this is important in signaling, and the signaling is for growth. I'm signaling growth constantly, and I get this chronic form, right? So in 1991, at the Dana-Farber Cancer Center in Harvard, they decided that this would be at this wild enzyme that's now deregulated because it's made by a fusion of this splice junction, right? That this would be a really interesting target to look for small chemical inhibitors that would stop the enzyme from working. Right? A small molecule that you take as a pill that would inhibit the enzyme from working. Now, they didn't know at the time that they might kill the patient, for example, because if this was an essential thing, taking a pill would really hurt. But if it's non-essential, but drives the cancer, it would be good. And so the pharmaceutical company Novartis, this is not an advertisement, and I don't own stock, right? The pharmaceutical company Novartis started making these inhibitors. And by 96, they had a really good inhibitor for the BCR-ABL protein kinase. Really good one in 1996. The first thing they did was prudent. They gave it to a mouse that had this disease caused by the same chromosome translocation, and they cured the mouse. Cured it, right? Mouse had to keep taking pills, but it went away, right? And so immediately they got FDA approval to go into human beings, and everyone in the chronic phase that took the pill, the cells disappeared. The cancer cells disappeared. There were no side effects, right? This is targeting a gene and targeting the protein the gene makes that's abnormal, and no side effects. Not like chemotherapy, which damages DNA, causes havoc, right? It's targeting genes for the first time in cancer, right? That had the shortest clinical trial of any drug that the FDA ever approved. They approved it in 2 years. So by 1999, 2000, people that had chronic myelogenous leukemia went on chronically this drug. Its name is Gleevec, right? And now they're completely free of the disease because it kills the cells. It stops the enzyme that comes from the fusion, that comes from the merger of two genes that causes the kinds of cancer, right? Now, unfortunately, it's a little bit like antibiotic therapy. Resistance occurs to the drug, right? Just like penicillin resistance occurs. These are living cells, they mutate, they change. But what's really good is that we now have second and third generation Gleevecs, which kill the resistant cells. So about 1 or 2% of people on this drug every year become resistant, and they start switching into the second generation drug and the third generation drug, right? Now, there are 4,000 cases of chronic myelogenous leukemia a year in the United States. It is really a very small potatoes cancer. There are 500,000 cases of cancer a year in the United States. There's 4,000 of these. But this is a model, we think, of how we're going to go about using the genome and using genes and using enzymes that we now understand can cause disease, to cure disease, to stop disease, to even prevent disease if we can, right? And so there's no doubt that we're just at the beginning of this process. We want to do what we did for chronic myelogenous leukemia for many other diseases and understand them at the genetic level. And the beginning is this parts manual we call the Human Genome Project. Thank you very much. Oh, yeah. I'm okay.
That was great. I'm going to open the floor to questions. We usually have a great question session after these talks. But let me bring you the microphone. I had a question to begin with. Didn't understand. Is it the immune system that's combating this?
This last disease?
Gleevec?
No. Gleevec is a small chemical.
No, I understand.
That enters the cell and stops the ABL protein from working. And it is the protein that's driving the disease, so we stop it.
What is the resistance?
Resistance is a mutation in the gene, ABL. Ah. So what happens is the protein no longer binds the drug. So the protein, one probably nice way to think about it is the protein has a shape, right? And the shape says something about its function. And the drug is tailored to get into the cleft of the protein and prevent it from working. And if the protein does that, it releases the drug. And that's a mutation, that change in shape, right? So the same drug doesn't bind very well. So what we do is make a drug that looks like that, right? And like antibiotics, we have to keep doing that, right? You know, because antibiotics are used promiscuously, we're making new antibiotics all the time because the bacteria now get used to the old ones. And so it's the gene that actually mutates and beats the system, yeah.
So with the second generation, if the second generation drug loses its effect, can you go back to the first generation?
No, because mutations are permanent things, right? And they accumulate in the cells. So the cell that has the second generation mutation also has the first. Now, there's a way to beat this. This is very good for an Institute of Theoretical Physics. I'm going to make a calculation with you quickly. This is the way antibiotics are used. If you have a really bad infection, and we're worried about resistance, we don't give you one antibiotic at a time, right? Because if we gave you one at a time, for every million cells, you'd find one resistant one, right? So that's a frequency of 10 to the minus sixth, right? And so if I gave you the first antibiotic at a frequency of one in a million, you would have a resistant one. And then it would grow up, that one. And then I gave you the second antibiotic, it would be the same thing, one in a million, it would grow up. But if I gave you both simultaneously, it would be 10 to the minus 12th, right? So by giving them simultaneously, it's two independent events, because the mutations are independent events, and that's the way to kill the bugs, right? So we actually want to give to new people that haven't had this drug, two of them simultaneously, and then resistance will go away.
And with age, you need five of them.
And yes, that's right. The older you are, the more you'll need, yeah.
I wonder about the sequentiality of the genetic code. A linear sequence would be the most obvious thing to use, but what if it jumps? What if it's every third one or follow some Fibonacci thing or some crazy thing? I mean, why is it literally linearly sequential? Is it just part of the chemistry of it?
In bacteria, it is linearly sequential. First of all, the genetic code is a linear sequence. It's not an overlapping code. You could have imagined that ATG would have used the G for the first letter of the next guy, right? But it doesn't happen. ATG is the codon that starts all proteins, actually. And like any good syntax, the genetic code has a start codon, right, which is like a capital letter for us. So ATG, it has a stop codon, which is like a period. In fact, there's three stop codons. UAG, UGA, and UAA, right, I switch from T to U, are the stop codon. So it has periods at the end, capitals at the beginning of every sentence, right? And that's how we know a gene starts and a gene ends, right? So that's good. And in bacteria, it's just a linear readout of that. For higher organisms, things got more complicated. What happened was that if, let's say, a protein has 1,000 of these A's, T's, G's, and C's, this gene has 1,000 of them, it often splits them up into 300, and then there's a space of junk, right? And then it's another 200, and there's another space of junk, and there's another 200. Now, you could ask the question, how does this get back together again? Well, it gets back together just as you'd splice a movie together, right? You read the whole thing, and then you splice two of them together and throw out the middle, right? And there's a great splicing machine in your nucleus, and the great splicing machine is one of the great editors of life. And it edits your genome so that these bits and snips. Now, that's what makes it so hard for us to guess how many proteins you have, because we have to put together them in bits and snips, right? And we're not great splicing machines. We're not great editors. So we don't know all the answers yet, but the genome's very complex because it comes to us in parts, not contiguously.
You said that a certain percentage of the stuff in there is pretty much useless. Now, I guess you might ask,
why is it there?
Why is that? But I guess one way of thinking about it is if you look at different species which have different amounts of genetic material, is the amount of useless stuff pretty much uniform among the species, or is this just something that happens in more complex organisms?
No, it's very different in different species. But let me tell you something about your junk, right? It's important that you don't go away thinking that this is just totally junk, right? 45% to 55% of the stuff that doesn't have any information to make you are the remnants of parasites that live in your chromosomes. But what do I mean by parasites? Viruses, right? Viruses that got into the germline of our ancestors many, many years ago are present in their genetic information in our chromosomes. Now, because they're there for such a long time and you don't need them to live, they drift away. The sequences changes. They collect SNPs without any selection at all. So most of these viruses are dead viruses, right? Some of them are actually alive, but most of them are dead. And for example, there's a particular virus-like particle in your genome. It's one I'm working on now in the lab. We really like it a lot. It's called the LINE1 virus, LINE-1. It's just a nickname that everybody gives it for reasons that are uninteresting. So you have 750,000 line 1 elements in your genome. Right? That's remarkable. These things are about, these things are 9,000 base pairs long. 9,000 A's, T's, G's, and C's. You have 750,000 of them. They've amplified themselves up and moved around your genome and littered you with this line element. Most of them are dead, right? In fact, of the ones we know are alive, by live I mean they can come out of your genome and move, there are only 300 left. But they are responsible for 0.1% of all mutations in the humans. Right? So what these elements do is they sit in your chromosomes, they get changed into a molecule called RNA, they then get changed back into DNA copies and reinserted a different spot in your genome. That's how they duplicate themselves, right? That's how they got to be 750,000. They move, they're jumping genes, right? But sometimes they move in the middle of the genes, right? So there's a family in Wisconsin where that element moved and it jumped into the gene for a clotting factor, right? Factor 8, which gives the whole family hemophilia A. They're clotter. And that's a completely new mutation in that family. There's another family in France where it moved into a gene for muscle protein, right? And they got Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, right? So muscular dystrophy, genetic cause by knocking out this protein. 0.1% of all changes in human beings are mediated by these jumping genes, right? So these are parasites, 45% of our heritage. Right? This is an archaeological dig if you look at the genome, right? It's our heritage all the way back. And what are we littered with? We're littered more than, we only have 30,000 genes. We have 750,000 copies, right? Only 30,000 genes. 750,000 copies of a parasite that got into our ancestor, maybe before the mouse, maybe by the fish, who knows when, right? And is with us. Now, we actually see relatives of this parasite in yeast all the way through human beings. So the genome is interesting. It's littered with these archaeological things, but I didn't consider them because they're not in the coding information that makes us, right? Although some of them, as I say, 300 of them, had a big impact on us. Right? So what I call junk was a little facile. I probably should have said, you know, it's for an archaeologist, it's fodder. It's really good stuff, right? And then there's some other stuff which really truly does look like junk. Maybe errors or mistakes or something. But almost every one of these things has a history that will become interesting in the future.
And that's where I'd like to go back to that divergence between the chimpanzees and the humans, yeah. That 1%. Were there specific triggers? Was it random? Were there these little jumping objects? And then what are the kind of the generalized differences that 1% means?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So let me tell you what's similar and what's different about us, right? Anatomically, the chimpanzee doesn't have the same voice capabilities we have. In fact, the chimpanzee, even though it's smaller than us, is much stronger than us. They're really built very strong. If you give a chimpanzee your arm, he could break it, just like that, right? So extremely strong, very different in the larynx area and in the jaw area and in the thorax area, structurally different. I don't know what the genes are that make those things different, but structurally different. And its brain is slightly different. I mean, you can see differences in the brain anatomically. It doesn't look like it has as well-developed a region of the brain for language as we do, for example. That's maybe one of the things that makes us a little special, is the region of the brain for language. Many people sort of begin to believe the chimp may be as smart as us, but not as linguistic as us. Can't tell you that he's smart, right? So how do you know how smart the chimp is, right? I mean, it might be a very clever animal, or even person, right? I mean, really, really clever. So we don't have a good chance to know that, but there are these anatomical differences that separate us. It's virtually remarkably small differences. Some people will believe, although this is really speculation, that the chimp is producing different amounts of certain substances of genes in different places, right? And that may be the anatomy, and at different times. So it isn't the genes that are as important, the quality of the genes, it's the place, time, and amount that's important. And those are important variables. The time you make something is very important. Think about language. You acquire language at a certain time. If you don't acquire it at that time, you're finished, right? I mean, you can learn language, but you'll never be great at it. You can learn the violin, but you'll never be great at it, right? So the time is an important variable, and when you express things and when it happens is important. So there may be regulatory elements that are quite different in the chimp and us, and we're really anxious to complete the sequence of the chimp and line it up with the human and ask, is there some insight that I could get from this? But I don't have the insight right now other than the structural things.
Yes, one of the ways over the last several years of using genetic engineering, right here.
I'm sorry. Yeah, oh, okay.
One of the ways that's been proposed for using genetics to fight disease has been using a retrovirus, which I understand goes back, is given to a human being and repairs the DNA in every cell in the body. Is that accurate? And I'm wondering, is this efficacious?
So I'm not going to use a retrovirus because that isn't commonly used as much as another virus. So I'll tell you this. You'll see how that your question is could be answered. Remember, I mentioned that there are families that don't have this gene, P53. And more than that, there are only 450 families of that type. More than that, about 55% of people who develop cancer have mutations in the P53 gene, the somatic mutations. They're not in the germline, but they're in the chromosomes of the cancer cells. If you replace the P53 gene, it kills the cancer cells. That's why it's the death gene, right? So it's a killer, and it's lost because it would have killed the cells, right? It's like if you went out in the sun, it would have killed your skin cell that had mutations. So pharmaceutical companies got the idea very early, that's the idea you just had, of putting the gene back in a virus and letting the virus infect the cancer. And it works. If you put that virus into the cancer, it gets into the cells and it kills the cells. The biggest problem is not a problem of strategy, it's a problem of delivery. There are about 10 to the 11th cells in the tumor, and you don't kill 10 to the 11th cells, we deliver it to about 10 to the 9th cells. So the tumor shrinks, but it never is efficient. So we have no efficient delivery system to do gene therapy, which is what you want to do. Gene therapy would be replacing a defective gene. And it's that inefficiency that stopped us. So if I chose another disease, not cancer, but cystic fibrosis, the lack of a gene in making a protein in the lungs of kids so that they can't clear the bacteria out of the lungs, right? It's like a flagella that clears it out and it doesn't work, right? If you could replace that gene in the lung cells, you would get it to work again. That's pretty clear. But we can't replace it so efficiently as to get it to work. Right? So gene therapy has been stopped not because it isn't a good idea, somatic gene therapy. Somatic means put it into your lung cells, put it into the cancer cells, not putting into sperm and eggs. That's germline gene therapy. But somatic gene therapy has been stopped because the delivery system isn't good enough. No one that I know of in science wants to do germline gene therapy because we don't want to change what humans are abnormally and try to make changes forever because we don't know enough. We don't think it would work anyhow.
You compare various things. The chimp is 99%, the mouse is 95%. That implies to me that we're kind of finished. Or are we finished in terms of...
Sorry you feel that way.
The evolution of... Do we have further jumps that we can
do? First of all, you couldn't stop it if you wanted to, right? I mean, pretty clearly, we're evolving from generation to generation. Your offspring may carry 10 to 100 mutations that you don't have, right? That you've passed on because you make mistakes as you pass it along. I mean, think about it. If you try to reproduce 3 billion bits of information every time you divide, right? That's a very daunting task. Reproduce identically 3 billion bits of information. There's no machine that can do that. So you make errors just by reproducing yourself. But forget about those errors. There's cosmic rays coming in, changing your genetic information. Tomorrow morning you go out in the sunlight. Tonight you may actually eat something that will ruin your intestine with mutations, right? You'll breathe the air and get out here and Santa Barbara, the air's too good, but if you were in New Jersey, you'd breathe the air and you'd get mutations in your lungs. There's no way that you can change, right? No way you could stop the change, right? So we will continue to evolve. There's just no doubt about it. And, you know, a million years from now, we won't be what we are today, and that's for sure. We'll be something else. I mean, it will look a little bit like us, and presumably will not look like a mouse, but we will be something else, right? I don't think we'd go backwards to mice. I think we'll go forward to something else. Just shout it out. Yeah. The Neanderthals that for which there were bones, this is DNA taken from bones, there's nothing else left. The Neanderthals for which there were bones were probably 20 to 25,000 years old, and that's the getting close to the, we only got fragments of the DNA. There were enough to do the comparison and see that they were very different than any human, right? Remember the bog man? The bog man was the guy, he wasn't the bog man, that was a bog man, and was a 11,000-year-old guy that got in a bog in Florida, right? And then there was a 12,000-year-old guy that was crossing the Alps, do you remember him? And he got frozen, and he was in great shape, right? So 12,000 years, we got his DNA, right, and found out that he was just one of those guys from Europe, right? I mean, you know, that I told you about, that came out 20,000 years ago. Well, he was boring, actually, right? He looked like present Europeans. 12,000 years ago, he was around. So that's not hard. It starts to get hard. So you'll remember a very clever idea that I guess this guy Crichton had in Jurassic Park, right? So he took amber. And amber actually completely petrifies, well not petrifies, but completely immortalizes the degradation of flies and insects. In this case, who had sucked blood from dinosaurs, right? And he went in and got the dinosaur nucleus from the dinosaur, which had red blood cell, which had a nucleus, and he could reconstruct the dinosaur that way. People have cut open amber, but it's not that good. You get hydrolysis. DNA is probably, what hurts it is oxidation over time. And so that's called hydrolysis. And 20,000 years is pretty much the limit of what anybody's gotten. It's not, I mean, there have been dinosaurs and a whole bunch of other things that people have tried, but have not gotten much DNA out of.
In your talk, your superb talk, I might add.
Thank you. I don't know where you are, but thank you. Oh, okay.
You implied one or two things. One, that the driving force behind evolution is mutation. And second, that there's an enormous number of mutations that we were all subjected to. I read here and there that there may be as many as 10, 20, 30,000 mutations a day. Maybe it's an hour. If those numbers are
not with you, but maybe collectively in the population.
then that suggests random has the important role or element of evolution.
So the fodder, you're right about the fodder for evolution is mutation or change, and it is by and large, I don't want to say it's solely, but by and large it's random. And if you took it over the average of all the chromosomes, it's random. It turns out you have some genes which have higher mutation rate than others, and that turns out got selected. It's a selective advantage. One of those genes is the genes that are important for rejecting transplants of organs, right? The reason you have no match in this audience is the mutation rate for that gene is very high, right? So you're really different at that gene than almost everybody in the audience. And that's why it's hard to get a tissue match. That sounds like, I mean, evolution never acted upon transplants. I mean, transplants are, something of the 20th century. It's nothing of evolution. Evolution was acting on that gene because it made us immunologically diverse. It allowed me to respond, or allowed you to respond to influenza where I couldn't, right? Or other kinds of things like that. So there's certain things for which diversity is wonderful, and that's the immune system, because that means that if a good example is AIDS virus. So we now know that 7% of all people are resistant to the AIDS virus. They can't be infected with the virus. And that's because of the SNP. There's a SNP at a gene called CCR5, right? And it's a receptor on the surface of a lymphocyte that the AIDS virus attaches to. And so if the AIDS virus really attacked everybody in the population, if it got around badly, 7% of the population would live, and they would become the population of the future, right? And so that would be a great example of selection pressure, right? That 7% would contribute to the future. but we would be considerably narrowed in their diversity, right? Because of that. So it is true that mutation drives evolution. There's many other things that drive evolution that I really didn't talk about at all because of the technical things that aren't related here. But one of them is recombination, right? So your chromosomes can recombine so that in you, you have your mother's chromosome and your father's chromosome. When you pass them along, you didn't just pass along your mother's or your father's. You actually pass along a combination of them. Something that's a hybrid between the two. And that's because there's a machine that goes along and catches a little bit of your father and then a little bit of your mother and a little bit of your father and a little bit of your mother. And that chromosome, number 11, moved on to your offspring, right? And that drives evolution very, very strongly. It's a terrific mechanism that means your children are not literally like your parents or your grandparents. Your children are combinatorics of your grandparents and your parents, right? And it's a very valuable way to give diversity to the population fast. So there are other mechanisms that drive evolution, but the fundamental one that Darwin pointed out, and Darwin didn't understand mutation or genes or DNA or anything. I mean, Darwin just said we're very diverse. There's a population of diversity, and natural selection acts on that diversity. So that if everybody here got infected with a virus and 7% lived, that would be a selection of the 7% that survived and they would move on. That's a very Darwinian kind of idea.
I was thinking that the DNA sequence is somewhat like a computer program. And it seems to me that this computer program that's in humans has the ability, and somewhere within it, its own self-analytical part of a program. In other words, it has the ability to actually look at its own program.
Yes.
and analyze that.
Yeah.
And presumably that is what is uniquely human.
Yes. So there's a you bring up an interesting point. So I started with the great Greek philosophers. I'll end with 20th century philosophers who asked a very different kind of question. And this is relevant to why anybody would hire a neurobiologist at a university, right? Is there such a thing as a machine that can understand itself? Right? Is a question you could ask. And if you believe that there is no such thing as a machine that can understand itself, we'll never understand our own brain. The neurobiological problem. But that'll be an interesting challenge for neurobiology of the future. Because we obviously are limited in our abilities to understand some things, and we're obviously limited, except for physicists, I mean, but we're obviously limited in our ability to understand some things, and we're obviously limited in capabilities of some sort. So those limitations are going to be interesting. Now, code, I don't think, is one of our limitations. These great code breakers are the guys that are probably work over the genome and find things about repeats and elements and things that would be terrific, because it is... There are themes in the DNA, so to speak, just like there are when you break a code, right? And code breakers are looking at these sequences and things now. But there is, I think, the bigger question for us that's relevant to your point is a good one, is that will we ever understand the brain? Will we ever understand our brain, our way of thinking, the consciousness that is us, that is no other animal that we think of? And that's really true.
I've got to ask, I mean, why do you say we're limited?
Oh.
And I don't mean...
Well, I mean, excluded physicists.
I that's okay. But you said we're obviously limited. I would say we're obviously...
Extraordinary.
Historical record, yeah. Unlimited. We haven't yet encountered, yeah, problems we can't solve.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well... I mean, we're limited in the sense that, that we're only as good as our own wiring circuits, right? And there are more wiring circuits than the ones we have. In fact, we probably, it's sort of interesting. Clearly, infants are born with wiring that degenerates. If they don't, if you don't use it, you lose it, kind of obvious thing. And so it may, in fact, be that just our culture has systematically allowed something to erode from us that is not developed. Maybe we were unlimited in our capability, but we limited ourselves through culture. But I think we're not even there for... I think we have a finite wiring diagram, and therefore not an infinite capability, is my thought when I say we're obviously limited. I speak for us biologists, though. Who know our place?
But in addition to genes, but memes don't necessarily have to be limited.
The memes can go on, the cultural.
And we advance collectively. Mm. Luckily, we don't have to reinvent culture.
Yeah, after Mozart, no one thinks about limits.
Well, let's thank Arnie again for a wonderful talk. And there are refreshments in the common room and shuttle buses leaving for parking.